Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Simona Dinnerstein. She performs in Philadelphia as part of Bach Festival Week. And Susan Lewis looks ahead to the celebrations of all things Bach in Philadelphia. We visit the Center for Emerging Visual Artists. The center is dedicated to making art careers viable for those who choose them. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the art and craft of quilting as enthusiasts across the country celebrate National Quilting Day today. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
After she graduated from Juilliard, pianist Simona Dinnerstein worked in relative obscurity for the first 10 years of her career. Then in the early 2000s, the Philadelphia nonprofit Astral Artistic Services began representing her. In 2004, she performed at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre as part of the new music series Fresh Ink. In 2005, she made her Carnegie Hall debut, and since then her star has been on the rise. Simona Dinnerstein recently stopped by our studios. I first asked her if she was now pleased with the way her career was taking shape.
You know, I feel that my career path has been somewhat unusual. I didn't have like an early success in my 20s. I didn't win any international competitions. In fact, I really didn't get past preliminaries in many of them. And I think that it was just not meant to be for me to have that kind of concert route. Actually, Astral has been a really important career development for me, because I was kind of in my mid-20s when they took me on. I guess I was maybe even my late 20s, and nothing had been really happening in terms of like a, you know, sort of prominent concerts. I was steadily playing concerts, but in small venues. It's very hard to get booked into larger venues if you don't have management. And Astral really kind of focused me and helped me to just see what my strengths are and to develop those strengths, and presented me in some important recitals. But the interesting thing about it is that I had my son. I guess I was 29 when I had my son. And I had always been worried since I was a kid. I was the kind of person who worried years in advance for things. I was always worried, how would I ever be able to have a child and have a career? And that was always a concern of mine. And because, you know, being a musician and also being a woman, you know, you have to be very self-centered and very focused and spending loads of time practicing. And, you know, you travel a lot as a musician. But what's interesting is that my career took off after I had my son.
And, it's always the way.
Yeah.
What you least expect is what you're going
to
get.
And it's interesting because in the playground, when I've talked to other women, that's been true for many women in different professions that I've talked to in the playground, that their careers somehow started to really take off after having kids. And I don't know why that is, and I've thought about it a lot. I think that it might be that you become more focused when you have a child, because you realize what's important and you need to get everything done in a shorter amount of time.
And when you are working, you really need to be...
You really need to get it done. And, you know, for me, I feel like my playing between my 20s and my 30s really grew a lot. And in a way, I'm glad that none of these really big breaks happened for me when I was in my 20s, because I don't think my playing was mature enough, or I don't know if I was mature enough to have taken responsibility for my own interpretations in the way that I feel that I'm doing it now.
Did you know that at the time, or was it just very frustrating for you that the breaks weren't coming along?
You know, it was frustrating. I felt, you know, of course, I felt sometimes that I saw things happening to friends of mine that weren't happening to me, and it's hard not to feel jealous, you know, and it's not a good feeling to have. And I realized that what is very interesting is that right before, I guess, you know, around when I was like 32, 33, I kind of made the decision that I did not want to be a bitter musician. You know, I really had to make a very conscious choice about that. You know, I thought, I'm doing this to play the piano and for the music and to play with other great musicians, and I don't care where I play. you know, I enjoy playing in a little town just as much as I do on a big stage. And I've seen plenty of musicians in their 60s who are really, they're really angry. You know, they feel that they've been trying and they've not been appreciated. And on one level, it's true. But on the other level, you know, you have to accept that there are very few spaces in the world for the very, very big prestigious careers. And I'm not even sure if that's always the best life to have also, you know, to be on the road all the time. So I thought to myself, this dream of the international career with the concertos, whatever, I thought, you know, I'm just going to let that go because it's not helpful to me to be thinking about that. And was that
liberating in some way then?
Well, the thing that's so weird is that that coincided with me deciding to record the Goldberg Variations. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do something that I really want to do artistically, which is to make this recording. And then as soon as I kind of let go and I just focused on what I wanted to do with my playing, suddenly people started to approach me in a very different way. And I got interviews with various big managements and then got taken on by, like, really one of the biggest managers in the United States. And now getting this record contract, which is very, you know, these are very difficult things to achieve. And there are so few of these kinds of opportunities. So I don't know. It's funny because now I'm thinking, well, you know, I actually am playing much more internationally now. I don't, you know, I'm not saying that I'm, you know, kissing, but my career is very different than it was a few years ago. And it does directly coincide with me having let go of wanting that. I don't know what that teaches you about life, but it's interesting.
An excerpt from Simona Dinnerstein's soon-to-be-released recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. Miss Dinnerstein will perform twice in the upcoming week. On Wednesday, she plays the Goldberg Variations at a gathering at a private home. On Thursday, her program at the Trinity Center for Urban Life is called Bach, Beethoven, and Beyond. Both performances are part of Philadelphia's Bach Festival. Music festivals began in Europe in the 19th century, but America now has an increasing share of its own such celebrations. Last night was the start of the 10-day festival, with multiple events and performances celebrating the life and work of Johann Sebastian Bach. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the man behind the mystique and the power behind the music.
Johann Sebastian Bach is one of the three big B's in Music 101. Over the years, his Baroque music has been performed, transcribed, electrified, and arranged for voices and instruments in ways that the 18th century composer would never have imagined. Or would he?
I have a good friend of mine. He improvises Bach in blues, in jazz. I rather think Bach would have enjoyed it.
Jonathan Sternberg is the artistic director of Philadelphia's Bach Festival. Founded in 1976, the Spring Festival now coordinates 30 events in 10 days in venues around the Philadelphia area, including churches, concert halls, college music rooms, and private residences. Sternberg says that with so many venues, Bach's music, much of which is intimate, can reach large numbers of people.
You can almost touch Bach when it's performed. It's there to touch, it's there to feel, it's there to absorb, to eat, to hold close to you. And I think, to me, that's one of the major reasons why we do Bach, to get as many people as possible who don't know of the wonders behind knowing and experiencing Bach.
Considering his historic stature and musical longevity, Johann Sebastian Bach led a rather ordinary 18th century life. Born in 1685, he was the eighth child in a family with a generations-long musical tradition. Because there were so many Johanns in his clan, he was known simply as Sebastian. His musical training came first from his father, town musician Johann Ambrosius Bach, then from his brother, organist Johann Christoph Bach, with whom the 9-year-old Sebastian and his brother Johann Jakob went to live after his mother and father died. After finishing studies at a Latin school in Lumberg, near Hamburg, Bach followed his family footsteps into the music business. Temple University Associate Professor of Music Studies, Stephen Zohn, says Bach climbed the professional music ladder rather quickly.
Most composers and performers worked for a municipality, say the city of Leipzig or Hamburg. You became a church musician, perhaps, and then the ultimate goal was to become a musician at a court. And Bach rose to those ranks while he was still in his 20s.
Creating music, not just playing it, was part of the job, and Bach composed the form required by the position he held. His early works as organist in town churches were for organ and chorus. When he moved to the court, first of the Duke of Weimar, then for the Prince at Köthen, he composed fugues and preludes, music for clavier, and concertos, like the famed Brandenburg Concertos. In 1723, Bach went to the great musical city of Leipzig, where he stayed until his death in 1750. In Leipzig, he taught and was music director of the principal churches in town. On a recent breezy day, Valentin Radu, artistic director of Vox Amadeus, marveled at Bach's productivity.
He had to write the whole cantata from scratch, from one Sunday to another. And he had to write the parts, had to collect the musicians, had to rehearse them to perform. And there was no Xerox machines, there was no computers. I mean, everything was done the old-fashioned way. Obviously, he did it.
But what distinguishes Bach from his peers is not his productivity, but the character of his compositions. Despite his tight deadlines, Stephen Zohn says Bach held himself to high standards.
He wasn't going to write music just to write it on commission. It had to be his way. It had to be complex and thoughtful and difficult to perform. And he was criticized during his lifetime for that. But that's one reason that we value his music so highly today. It wasn't just, well, I've got to write this cantata. Let me see what I can dash off in half an hour. Musicians talk about texture as if you're dealing with a cloth or something, but it's a good analogy because you can think of each melody as a strand in a cloth, and the more strands you have, the more dense and complex the cloth is, and that can describe music, and Bach tends to be rather dense.
Unlike some of his contemporaries, Bach never studied at a university, nor did he ever leave Germany. Yet his musical development reflected a combination of influences beyond the contrapuntal Germanic tradition in which he was raised. French influences from lessons in secondary school, Italian elements of harmony and theme, learned when he served the Duke of Weimar, when Bach studied and copied scores of Italians like Vivaldi, creating new arrangements for organ or harpsichord, in the process adapting his own style. He was religious as well as a family man, marrying and then remarrying after his first wife's death, and fathering 20 children in all. Bach's music shows the mathematical rigor of a scientist or architect. He's known to have composed works using notes that correspond to the letters of his last name. The complex structure of his music has inspired some people to look for layers of meaning, as Valentin Radu describes.
Numbers were an enormous factor of influence in Bach's life, in also mystical way. Like, for instance, he wrote a lot of things around the number 3, which represented the Holy Trinity. Also, he did various things related to events of his life, number of children that he had, and so on and so forth.
Mystical or not, Bach's music is no easier today than it was in his time. But his complexity translates into an emotional ride that few can match, says Jonathan Sternberg.
Bach flows, it runs, it turns, it moves, it's going somewhere. And one listens with that kind of interest. What will be next?
Bach died at the age of 65 after surgery for an eye infection. His music, like that of his contemporaries, fell out of fashion as the musical world focused on what was new. But organists kept his music alive, and his son Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach kept his manuscripts. Gradually, Johann Sebastian Bach was rediscovered in the 19th and 20th centuries as the pinnacle of the Baroque era. And true to the spirit of the master, Bach continues to be interpreted, reinterpreted, and reinvented today. The Bach Festival is stylistically varied, including period instrument performances, organ and vocal recitals, dance and choral works. The festival opened last night and runs through Sunday, March 25th.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Among the offerings during Bach Festival Week, Valentin Rado's Vox Amadeus performs selections at Gladwin Presbyterian Church tomorrow afternoon at 5. Next Saturday, Jonathan Sternberg leads the Bach Festival Orchestra at St. Mark's Church in Philadelphia. Your average young artist is full of dreams, with enough energy to paint 10 Sistine Chapels, eating ramen noodles for almost every meal. He or she may have the inspiration and perspiration, but often there's a missing link to the next stop, to get artwork into a museum, or at least to sell enough to stop working at that coffee shop. In contrast to many other fields, you can work at your art without ever making a living out of it, and figuring out how to be a paid working artist can be daunting.
In many professions, when you begin your career, there are all kinds of institutional and community support for the development of your career.
Meta Malone is the president and CEO of the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, or CEVA for short.
For many artists, there's really nothing there to support you, and you leave art school or you make the decision to be an artist, and it's like jumping into the abyss. So we're there so that there's no abyss.
The center serves both emerging and established artists, helping them wade through the business of the professional art world. Genevieve Katrubis, the center's director of programs, says one of the most important things the center teaches has little to do with art.
The biggest lesson I think that artists learn is how to present themselves. So I think the challenges that they face are how to write about themselves, how to prepare their work, how to basically present themselves in the art world.
This doesn't mean what black turtleneck to choose or which handbag to carry. Creating a professional resume and portfolio can be critical to professional success.
It's having a clear vision of what you're doing and being able to express that. It's making sure that everything that you submit is top quality. And I think sometimes as artists, people say, oh, you know, I don't have the money to make the best slides. Well, that's the most important thing. And we give people the tools to be able to say, this is how you do it.
One way the center trains artists to pursue their ambitions is through a 2-year fellowship program that helps with career development. Jeffrey Stockbridge is a current fellow.
It's real helpful for a lot of people that come out of college and don't know what to do next. And that was the case for me, because I graduated from Drexel in 2005. And you're out of school 6 months, and you say, well, what next?
Not only has Stockbridge learned how to navigate his career, CEVA has also helped to get it rolling.
CEVA has been a huge boost for me, in that I've had the opportunity to show all over Philadelphia. And now we are currently having a show at the Delaware Museum of Art, where they're showing 5 of my photographs. And I've never had a show in a museum before. So this is it's a big step. You know, it's a 5-month-long show.
That's another aspect of the center, connecting the artists with galleries and museums. In the center's Direct Dialogue series, experts and major players in the art world offer insights and advice. In one recent program, Making Your Way into Museum Collections, artists had a chance to talk to the often elusive but powerful figures in the art world, curators and directors. The talk takes place in a small gallery, offering a rare and intimate opportunity, as Genevieve Katrubis explains.
It gives people the opportunity to talk to our speakers and make those connections and ask very direct questions that they may not be able to ask if they just walked in off the street. Some other talks we've had are legal issues for artists. And we've had lawyers come and talk about issues that may cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars if someone picked up the phone and went to a lawyer's office just to get that advice.
Lastly, the center recognizes that the future of art depends not only on artists, but on the cultivation of an audience. It encourages audience development through October Open Studio Tours and some of the Direct Dialogue programs, as Meta Malone explains.
For the public, we have a Collecting Emerging Art series. So we're looking at sort of both sides of this relationship and this transaction and trying to educate an audience of confident art collectors, so that not only are we giving the artists opportunities, but we're trying to help create the audience that's going to be there to appreciate and collect their work.
The talent to create art and the marketing skills to find a public may not always go hand in hand, but the Centre for Emerging Visual Artists' goal is to build that bridge from artists to audience, creating meaningful connections for the enrichment of all. You probably already know that today is St. Patrick's Day. What you might not know is that today is also National Quilting Day. And while not every quilter may be aware of the celebration, there are undoubtedly quite a few of them around. According to a 2006 study entitled Quilting in America, there are more than 27 million quilters in the U.S. Furthermore, the study estimates they collectively spend about $3.3 billion annually on their passion. While WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer is not a quilter, he did recently become the proud owner of one, and so he decided to learn a little bit more about the craft and art form, starting close to home.
One tradition of my grandmother, Ella Root, a spunky, plain-clothed Mennonite woman who just turned 90, is to give a quilt to each of her grandchildren when they get married. She has 23 grandchildren, so this has been going on for a while. And quilts have been given to everyone but me. That is, until recently, when I finally got the chance to choose mine. To my knowledge, I'm not getting married anytime soon, but I suspect she wanted to finish up this tradition while she's in good health. As we sat in my parents' living room, she brought out a black trash bag stuffed with three colorful quilts.
This one I made all by myself. Open it up once. I mean, everything. I mean, I cut the patches, sewed them together, and I quilted it. Every stitch, no one helped me quilt it.
Grandma, when did you start quilting? Who taught you how to quilt? When did you start quilting?
I was a little girl. I believe I quilted already about 10 years old. And I did a lot of it since. I gave all the grandchildren each one, except you now. This, I have three here. You can pick one out.
She also gave me the choice to go to a store and buy one, but I opted to go with one she made. My new quilt displays a spectrum of colors. Blue, brown, green, yellow, even hot pink, made up of patterned fabrics from many of my grandmother's old dresses and aprons from 30 to 40 years ago. The pieces are arranged into alternating light and dark diamond shapes, one inside another. Otherwise, it's a fairly standard bed cover quilt, which is essentially like a sandwich of three layers. It has a bottom backing layer, a middle layer of fill called the batting, and then there's the decorative top layer, usually made up of many different pieces of fabric sewn together. The quilting is what holds these three layers together. It's important because if the layers weren't quilted, the batting in between would curl up. This sewing is traditionally done by hand in simple and elaborate patterns, but many people today use machines to do it. Although my grandmother hasn't been able to quilt much over the past 5 years because of her arthritis, she has a nearly 80-year history with the craft. Yet, relatively speaking, as one rooted in the Mennonite and Amish community of Lancaster County all her life, her quilting background isn't terribly unique. Peter Siebert, president of the Quilt and Textile Museum in Lancaster, which features a renowned collection of 83 Amish quilts from 1880 to the 1950s, describes the South Central Pennsylvania region as a sort of mecca for quilters to come to, because there is such a rich quilting history among the Mennonites and Amish of Lancaster. However, Siebert says the local tradition hasn't been around as long as some may think.
As we think of quilting out here, it's usually associated with the Pennsylvania Germans, who come here in the 17th and 18th centuries, settling kind of the back country of Pennsylvania. And these are the folks, most people think of the Amish today as sort of the most well-defined group of Pennsylvania Germans. But Mennonites, Schwenkfelders, Dunkards, all of those folks settling out here, that they brought quilting with them from, you know, the motherland. And in fact, they didn't. It was probably their association with the Quakers and the English who were settling in Chester County, Philadelphia County, who began to teach the Pennsylvania Germans.
Siebert says that even when store-bought blankets became much more inexpensive during the mid to late 1800s, and quilting consequently became less popular in American culture at large, Pennsylvania Germans never really gave up making them. For many people, like my grandmother, who grew up and got married during the Great Depression, quilting was a very practical thing, not merely a tradition or creative outlet. One reason she started quilting at such a young age was because she was expected to be well-prepared for marriage.
You were supposed to have a chest full of homemade quilts, and more in a chest, when you got married, or you didn't have anything. We called them hope chests. And we had them full when we got married, but we had to do it ourselves.
For many others, though, quilting is not done out of necessity. Instead, it's often a hobby, depending on who you ask, an art form or a craft. And while many quilt alone, it's commonly done in community. There's a rich history of people quilting in groups. Q2 is a quilting guild that meets in the Germantown area of Philadelphia. 8 to 10 women come together on the last Sunday of each month with lots of food and wine on hand to talk about and show their quilts to one another. And, of course, actually do some quilting.
This is a quilt for my son's school.
Sitting in a large sewing room on the third floor of her home with 2 sewing machines and piles of fabric scattered around the space, Sarah Bond is sewing the outer binding of a quilt that she's designed to resemble the large floorboard used in the game Twister. Bond started the Q2 Guild almost 10 years ago. She's been quilting since her college days, over 20 years ago.
For me, quilting is, well, it's about the quilt, but it's also about the society. It's about getting together with other people. It's a very social kind of an art. And one of the nice things about working in a group is that each person has strengths in a different area, and it stretches each of us as an artist.
Besides the communal aspect, others in the Q2 group, like retired K-12 art teacher Mariana Eckhart, point to a more tangible part of quilting as a big appeal.
I love the fabric. And after I cut the pieces up, I love playing with it and arranging it. I mean, the fabrics are like a palette, you know, like paints are a palette.
It's women like Mariana Eckhart and Sarah Bond that make up a bulk of the estimated 27 million quilters spread out across the United States today. According to a 2006 study, the average dedicated quilter is female, college-educated, and in her 50s. So where's the younger generation, those in their 20s and 30s or even 40s? It's hard to tell. While it's evident there are young people out there quilting, I personally had difficulty tracking down any. My grandmother suggests that today's generation simply has much less time and energy to dedicate to quilting. The dominance of one gender in quilting, women, is also notable. While there are some prominent men in the quilting world, Sarah Bond notes that they are undoubtedly in the minority.
When you do go to quilt shows, it's usually women, largely women, and there's a whole lot of men sitting on benches, you know, looking sort of put out and long-suffering.
Perhaps the beauty of quilting today is that there's a lot of room for change, growth, and innovation, which probably will attract more young people and maybe men down the road. Yet at the same time, quilting doesn't seem to be losing its sense of tradition and narrative. Books, magazines, museums, websites, and even a holiday or two are coming out all the time, celebrating the history. And speaking as a new quilt owner, I'm only too happy for the chance to hang on to a little bit of my past through the fabric of my warm and colorful grandmother.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Quilting Museum in Lancaster City is currently closed for renovations. It will reopen in September, and Jason's grandma continues to live in hope. Happy Quilting Day. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Guido Huben, Elizabeth Cochran and Christina Jensen. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.